This is BBC Radio 3. The time is 12 minutes past 10. Time now for the Sunday feature. This evening, Tristram Hunt begins a new three-part series, Ideas, the British Version. In this first programme, he examines the English Enlightenment philosopher John Locke's remarkable writings on religious toleration in the light of events past and present.
At the edge of Amsterdam's Oosterpark stands an abstract, wave-like statue, depicting a face moving into the distance and becoming steadily altered with each wave. It is entitled, after Edvard Munch, The Scream, and stands as a memorial to the Dutch filmmaker and controversialist Theo van Gogh, who was shot and then stabbed not far from here by a militant Islamist, Mohamed Bouyeri, in the name of religion. It was a murder of such disturbing, hideous brutality that it shattered the Western European and particularly Dutch reputation for religious tolerance. Suddenly, Europe seemed thrown back into the 17th century with a renewed era of religious extremism. But not this time between Catholicism and Protestantism, but rather Christianity and Islam, or even secularism and Islam. And the irony was all the starker, since it was here in Holland that the modern notion of religious toleration was first codified by the English philosopher John Locke. His 1689 Letter Concerning Toleration defined the contours for church and state, religious conscience and civic duty for centuries to come. And Locke on toleration is the first thinker we're setting out to explore in this series of programmes on Ideas, the British Version. So standing here, next to the Van Gogh Memorial, in the heart of liberal Amsterdam, in the heart of free, tolerant, multicultural Europe, the question is, how did these ideas arise and how have they evolved up until today?
Honoured sir, since you are pleased to inquire about what my thoughts are about the mutual toleration of Christians in their different professions of religion, I must needs to answer you freely that I esteem that toleration to be the chief characteristical mark of the true church. Let us inquire, in the next place, how far the duty of toleration extends and what is required by everyone by it.
In Amsterdam in the late 1680s, John Locke wrote his letter concerning toleration. Let me just read you a brief passage. Those whose doctrine is peaceable and whose manners are pure and blameless,
ought to be upon equal terms with their fellow subjects. Thus, if solemn assemblies, observations of festivals, public worship be permitted to any one sort of professors, all these things ought to be permitted to the Presbyterians, Independents, Anabaptists, Arminians, Quakers, and others with the same liberty. Nay, if we may openly speak the truth, and as becomes one man to another, neither pagan nor Mahometan nor Jew ought to be excluded from the civil rights of the Commonwealth because of his religion.
Now I'm joined here in the Boers von Berlacher by Ernestine van der Waal, the Professor of Religious History at Leiden University, and Peter Pickle-Herring, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Amsterdam. Ernestine, that strikes me as an extraordinarily modern argument, an almost sort of multiracial, multicultural argument which speaks to us today.
Yes, it is really a modern argument, and I think that we should see Locke's whole idea about toleration quite focused on religious toleration. So in that aspect, I think it's both of our society today, as it is an aspect of the historical context in which he was writing at the time.
Now, Peter, why was Locke in Holland? Why did he have to flee here from England in the 1680s?
Well, that was due to political reasons in England, and in general, you could say, and this also places England in a more or less European context. It was the worry that after the Civil War in England, Catholicism might rise again and might usurp political society all over again. And it was against this worry that Locke arose against, and he had to flee because Charles II and his sympathies with Catholicism. And he even in Holland was known as Dr. Van Linden. He had a pseudonym because he didn't want to be called Locke, because then he would be too easily traced by English spies. So, I mean, again, in the European context, although we had survived the religious wars and people were thinking never again, what kind of political structure was the right kind of structure to create peace and the means to create peace? That was in discussion, and that was what the most important topics of discussion were.
We're sitting in this marvellous, very colourful, modernist building, the old Amsterdam Stock Exchange. When Locke came here in the late 17th century, Amsterdam was a trading city, an entrepot, a people of places, ideas, cultures. How did that influence Locke's thinking, Peter?
The climate was the climate of a society which was very modern, and it was well aware of its rising power within Europe. It was also well aware that this power was based on its economic power, on its development of the sciences, on its technology. And it was an urbanized society to a large extent, Dutch society. And in this urbanized society, you could see that the idea of equality was more or less circling around in the minds of people, and it was also an equality of the sexes, for example. And this must have influenced Locke's thinking on toleration to a large extent, I think.
Locke also was writing perhaps the letter on toleration for the mercantile classes, you see. He was one of the visitors, but also other British travellers. They wrote about the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. They were struck by the fact that here all kinds of religious people were dealing together. So the stock exchange became a kind of symbol that here in the Netherlands people could coexist in this peaceful way, and that this had in this economic context.
The interesting thing is that there's this link with the idea of toleration in the following sense, that within these tracts on toleration, people tried to show that diversity and peace could coexist together, and that if you would stop diversity, that would lead to strife. And in the commercial sphere, you had the same kind of arguments. Namely, the traditional argument was create peace and then you will see that commerce will arise of itself. While now the argument was if you create commerce, you create a condition for peace. And that was a new kind of thought. That was a modern thought. And Locke was one of the first to develop this.
Ernestine, this is now a noisy, bustling coffee house, which again brings to mind that clash of ideas, that circulation of ideas. Tell us something about the intellectual context for Locke when he was in exile in Holland in the later 17th century.
In the Dutch Republic, there was a kind of structure. We had what we call a public church, but next to this dominant church, there was a whole broad spectrum of all kinds of denominations. The Netherlands, as is well known, the hallmark was that we had here a lot of religious groups. Foreigners were always struck by the fact that in the Netherlands all these people could live peacefully next to each other. But on the other hand, in the 1680s, when he arrived here, there was within the churches and within the various denominations a lot of strife going on. These were strifes between more liberally minded Christians and Orthodox Calvinist wings, so to say. So the Dutch Republic shows, well, two faces, one of this harmony among all these various religious sects, and the other face of having, well, perhaps the bottom line was that these Calvinist Orthodox wanted to establish a theocracy in the Netherlands. And that could also be one of the motives for him, besides his own personal motives, to write a letter concerning toleration.
Now I appeal to the consciences of those who persecute, torment, destroy, and kill other men upon the pretense of religion, whether they do it out of friendship and kindness towards them or not. And I shall then indeed, and not till then, believe they do so when I shall see those fiery zealots correcting in the same manner their friends and familiar acquaintances for the manifest sins they commit against the precepts of the gospel.
I'm now standing amongst the graves of such eminent figures as William Blake, John Bunyan, Richard Cromwell, in the heart of London, in the Bunhill Fields Cemetery. Joining me is Justin Champion, Professor of the History of Early Modern Ideas at Royal Holloway, University of London. Justin, what's the importance of this site?
If we think about what it was like to be a nonconformist, if you didn't subscribe and conform to the state church, you couldn't be buried in an Anglican church. So this rather large, I hate to think how many people were buried here, but this rather large graveyard is testament to where departed nonconformist and dissident souls were buried.
And how does that approach to nonconformity, to religious difference, separate England out from the Netherlands at this period?
Well, I think if we think about the two countries from the 1640s and 1650s, they're actually much closer together. Both are republics at that time. Both have an enormous range of religious diversity. So just as Holland has communities from Sephardic Jews, from Portuguese Jews, a whole range of different religions, so in the 1650s does England. Jews are allowed back into the country. There's an enormous efflorescence of sectarianism. But in 1660, the king is restored. And at the same time the king is restored, so is the church. So the two models of the Dutch and the English experience really diverge. In Holland, we can see that different religions live side by side. You can meet a Jew or a Muslim in a coffee house. They will still worship in their own communities. And I think that's one of the things we sometimes overemphasize amongst the Dutch community. Toleration is allowed. You can worship as you see fit. But there still is a state church. Calvinism is still very dominant.
In England, you seem to be suggesting that the official church was almost trying to put a lid back on the anarchy of the 1640s and 1650s, when the Civil War and the collapse of state authority allowed for this extraordinary flourishing of religious groups from the Diggers, the Muggletonians, the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians. Could they put the lid back on this?
It's one of the big problems for the restored monarchy. 1660s, we have the church restored, and London is a particular problem. All of the Republicans, they don't disappear. All of the ranters, all of the Muggletonians don't disappear. The fifth monarchists in the early 1660s are kicking off at Holborn, you know, ushering in the last reigns of Christ. So the church has a massive problem, and they address that problem with the law. So there's a whole range of legal restraints known as the Clarendon Code that insist on conformity. If you're a dissenter within London after 1665, you can't trade, for example. If you're a dissenting minister, you're not meant to hold a living within the walls of London. This is why Bunhill Fields is outside the city walls. If we think about the 1670s and 80s, this is a brutal society. It's a persecuting society.
So there are all sorts of civil penalties for religious opinion, whether it's banning them from the army or burial grounds like where we are, or standing for Parliament. Where does John Locke fit within this debate? What is he thinking about this situation?
Well, I think there's an interesting long history to that, because certainly in the early 1660s, John Locke thinks order is more important than conscience. And some of the first writings, the so-called two tracts, John Locke says, you know, religious conscience needs to be disciplined. But during the 70s, when he's working with the Earl of Shaftesbury and he's seeing the development of a much more stern persecuting Anglicanism, Locke starts to recognize that conscience, and especially the sincere Protestant conscience, needs to be preserved from interference by the state. But perhaps even more importantly, Locke is most upset with churchmen. It's the ecclesiastical authority he really, really resents. And Locke can see that popery, in quotation marks, so not just Roman Catholicism, but all forms of persecuting religious authority, are starting to infringe on what he calls absolute liberty.
Well, one of the places with very limited liberty, if you were a Protestant, was France under Louis XIV. And the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685 led to this exodus of Protestants, Huguenots, from France to England. We're now going to go to one of the most iconic civic symbols of that exodus in London, a church which still stands along Brick Lane to pursue these ideas further.
The gospel frequently declares that true disciples of Christ must suffer persecution, but that the church should persecute others and force others by sword and fire to embrace her faith and doctrine, I could never yet find in any of the books of the New Testament.
We've moved through East London now to the Brick Lane Jami Masjid, the Brick Lane Mosque, which used to be a synagogue, and before that was a church for the local Huguenot community who came here after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in the late 17th century. Locke is, of course, in Holland, both, it seems, for political and intellectual reasons. What was the level of religious intolerance in England which he had left?
If we think about London in the early 1680s, this very area where we are, this is a state that's actively persecuting. It's using holy violence. It's committing series of what we would call today atrocities against children, against women, and against communities.
So let's unpick this idea of tolerance and toleration. I'm joined also here by Dr. Hannah Dawson, the Locke expert from the University of Edinburgh. What is this difference between toleration and tolerance, Hannah?
I'm not sure that Locke would have seen particularly a difference between toleration and tolerance. I mean, we might think of tolerance being a more liberal, inclusive approach, and toleration is a rather kind of mealy-mouthed, quite nasty thing, in a sense, which is predicated on a view of superiority on the part of the tolerator. So I tolerate you, but you don't really have the right religion, and so I'll put up with you, but I'm not going to accept you as an equal. Whereas, of course, now we think of tolerance being about mutual respect and equality.
So John Locke wrote in 1689 a letter concerning toleration. What were the main points of Locke's thesis?
There are a number of arguments that he puts forward, and one of the ones that perhaps is most interesting to us as kind of modern secular liberals, as it were, is his view about the rigid separation between church and state. So he thought that these were two different institutions with different ends. The church was concerned with your well-being in the afterlife, the state with your well-being now, and one shouldn't mingle these ends.
The care of souls is not committed to the civil magistrate any more than to other men, because it appears not that God has ever given any such authority to one man over another as to compel anyone to his religion. Nor can any power be vested in a magistrate by the consent of the people, because no man can so far abandon the care of his one salvation as blindly as to leave it to the choice of any other, whether prince or subject, to prescribe to him what faith or worship he shall embrace.
We need to recognise the argument Locke is addressing. There is a pious and sincere theory of intolerance. The people Locke is arguing against believe it is their godly duty to save people's souls. Now, they are convinced that they have access to God. And their argument is, if I punish your body, if I coerce you physically, I'm saving your soul, so I'm actually doing a Christian act.
And Locke is very clear, however, it seems, that whilst he will allow any number of dissenting Protestant sects, our Congregationalists, our Presbyterians, our Muggletonians, he's not so keen on toleration for the Catholics. Why is that?
That's right. So Locke thinks that one can't tolerate Catholics because they owe allegiance to a superior power on this earth, that's to say, to the Pope, and therefore one can't expect them to be good citizens and obey the King, or, for example, England, because they follow the Pope.
Locke is hostile to ecclesiastical authority. It's churchmen. It's the church using the power of the state that causes oppression and persecution. And one of the themes underlying that is Locke says, I alone know what I believe. Nobody else is capable of believing for me. So the state, the prince, the bishop, they've got no better access to the truth than I have. And God will only save me, not on somebody else's behalf, not because they've told me the truth, but if I sincerely believe it. So there is a very powerful commitment to the individual making their way to some sort of religious truth for themselves.
Hannah, is this a quintessentially liberal idea? Is this where we see the seeds of modern liberal society, liberal governance, allowing people their own path?
Well, in many ways, we can see there being extremely illiberal edges to Locke's arguments about toleration. As you've already mentioned, he didn't tolerate Catholics, or we ought to say also atheists. And also, in particular, he said that one shouldn't tolerate any opinions that might have the consequence of threatening the public safety. And, of course, that is something that we can think of now in terms of the illiberal edges of liberalism, that still the government is weighing up in the balance the liberties of free speech and the security of the state. And if they think that the latter is threatened, then they think that it's legitimate to say that you can't say certain things.
One of the striking things, it seemed to me, reading the letter, was this clear argument in favour of toleration, not just for other Protestant dissenters, but for Jews and Muslims. Was that a novel idea at the time, Justin?
I think it is fairly novel. There are mosques and there are community synagogues around Europe, but actually explicitly arguing that Jews and Muslims, because they are sincere, can be tolerated is a new thing, I think.
In the terms of the history of ideas, where does Locke stand? Is this a major moment in Enlightenment thought?
Well, I think that Locke was certainly an apostle for ideas about toleration in the 18th century and was certainly an important voice in arguing for it. However, the arguments later that were developed about toleration in the 18th century and that perhaps we are more indebted to had their foundation in a far more secular set of arguments about universal human rights. So Locke was arguing for a right to toleration and a right to the freedom of religious expression, but it was a specifically religious right that he was arguing for, whereas now we think about, and people like Voltaire, they wanted to argue for the right to freedom of expression as one among many rights, whereas we know for Locke it was a specific right for religious freedom and there were many limits upon it and many people excluded from it.
Now, I think we've probably forgotten in one sense that Locke is also a theologian. He writes The Reasonableness of Christianity, which argues that there's a very minimal creed to Christian faith. And one of the core points of that is you read Scripture and you engage with God's Word. And the core theme he drags out of that is a Unitarian one. So it's ironic that we're here in a mosque, because Locke is accused of being a Muslim because he is anti-Trinitarian. He sees that there is a unity to God. So although Locke is an apostle of a certain brand of liberalism and the text gets used that way, he is also a very particular sort of Christian.
The toleration of those that differ from others in matter of religion is so agreeable to the gospel of Jesus Christ and to the genuine reason of mankind that it seems monstrous for men to be so blind as not to perceive the necessity and advantage of it in so clear a light.
As Hannah Dawson suggests, one of the lead Enlightenment figures inspired by John Locke was the French philosopher Voltaire. In contrast to the cultural conservatism of Ancien Régime France, where religious uniformity deadened intellectual life, Voltaire celebrated, as Locke had done in Holland, the freedom of worship and thought which he witnessed in England. Despite the official status of the Church of England and the laws enforcing its supremacy, Voltaire acclaimed this country as the land of sects. An Englishman, as a free man, goes to heaven by whatever route he likes. Nicholas Cronk is director of the Voltaire Foundation at the University of Oxford.
Well, Voltaire is, of course, an enormous admirer of Locke. Voltaire was born in the late 17th century, in the 1690s, and through his life, Voltaire went on emphasising the importance of Locke as a philosopher who was a founding presence, really, for the Enlightenment. The core of Locke's epistemology is to talk about empiricism, to say that we're born with a mind like a tabula rasa, where our mind is a blank at birth. Man acquires knowledge through sense impressions. That was the core of Locke's epistemology. By implication, it's a rejection of Cartesianism, which believed in innate ideas. Now, that sounds a bit remote from questions of toleration, but of course it's connected, because if you believe in innate ideas, it's easier to smuggle in ideas about the innate power of kings or the innate authority of the church. If you believe with Locke that man is born really knowing nothing and building knowledge up from sense impressions, then the political corollary of that is to say one should be tolerant of different views and so on. So Voltaire is interested in Locke because it provides a sort of philosophical underpinning for what he sees as the importance of toleration. Voltaire doesn't actually argue for absolute toleration. There won't be in France complete legal toleration of all religions, including, say, Jews, before the French Revolution.
But it was the American, rather than French Revolution, which really saw Locke's ideas on toleration come to fruition. His thinking had already influenced the drafting of state constitutions in Virginia as well as Pennsylvania, which explicitly stated that all men have a natural and unalienable right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own conscience and understanding. Roger Smith is Professor of Political Science at the University of Pennsylvania.
In the 1770s and 1780s, during the Revolutionary period, when Americans have to answer the question of the relationship of the new governments that they want to create to religion, as well as to justify the revolutionary enterprise, on both these topics, Locke's influence was very extensive. Locke's letter concerning toleration was in the library of all leading American thinkers. It was incorporated in early American college curricula. It was probably his most widely read work in America, and it is directly echoed in the writings of Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, urging religious freedom in the state of Virginia in the 1770s and 1780s. And those writings, in turn, were the background for the First Amendment to the Constitution, helping make the United States the first nation that did not have an established religion.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech.
In 1777, Jefferson drafted a bill for religious freedom that in many ways was modeled on Locke's essay concerning religious toleration, used many of the same arguments to oppose religious establishment. Just looking at Jefferson's bill for establishing religious freedom, he begins saying that the opinions and belief of men depend not on their own will, but follow involuntarily the evidence proposed to their minds. That is, we don't really have a choice about the evidence that persuades us. The same argument appears both in the first part of Locke's letter concerning toleration and in Locke's essay concerning the human understanding. The next argument Jefferson gives is that it is the will of God that people come to faith only through voluntary persuasion rather than being coerced into belief. And again, there are several passages in Locke's letter where he makes precisely that argument. And they both say that if you simply seek to impose religion on people, the result will be violence and tumult. And so this argument that you'll get peace only with religious toleration, religious freedom, is common to both. And Locke provided a template not only for the arguments that worked for greater religious freedom in the United States, he also provided the template for the arguments that were used to justify the American Revolution itself.
In contemporary America, the spirit of Locke is still much in evidence. On the other side of the Atlantic, the defense of First Amendment rights are absolute. Only the threat of imminent violence allows for limitations on free speech, however repugnant. By contrast, in Britain and continental Europe, governments today are much keener to limit freedoms of expression, to outlaw hate speech and incitement to religious or racial hatred in the name of a new understanding of toleration, respect, and social cohesion. In the wake of 9/11 and 7/7, this balance between freedom, security, and respect has become an area of particular sensitivity with regards to parts of the Muslim community. Yet Rashid Ali of the Quilliam Foundation, a new counter-extremism think tank, still sees the value of John Locke in this contemporary debate.
There's a number of parallels that are drawn, and one of the conversations that you mentioned was his apparent lack of tolerance for Catholicism at the time. And the main aspect, I think this probably plays into some of the debates and discussions we're having about belonging and citizenship and allegiance, is he's speaking about the Pope not from the perspective of religious leadership, but from the perspective that it undermines civil authority if you have allegiance to another political authority outside of our civil authority. And this, I think, resonates with some of the debates and discussions that go on today, specifically with regards to Muslim communities and regards elements of not mass Muslim community, but in terms of politicized religious elements that seek to show allegiance to a state which they either want to create, such as the Al-Qaeda-type, caliphate-type notion, or even lesser Islamist states, which the more apparently moderate elements would also seek to call for within the radicalized political Islamist elements.
Justin, do you feel Locke has anything to say about the debates about religious toleration and the rule of law today? I mean, do you buy into this, as some have suggested, this correlation between the treatment of Islam today and Catholicism in the late 17th century?
I think certainly reading Locke's letter and thinking about the contemporary way Islam, and especially a radicalized form of Islam, is vilified, that the parallels between the treatment of Roman Catholicism and now are absolutely appropriate. And you know, we need to recognize that the culture we're living in is a product of that Anglican, sort of Lockean Judeo-Christian tradition that says certain sorts of religions, when they enter into the public sphere, are dangerous. So I think what we see with Locke was a radical. Locke's advance of toleration into a culture where toleration was a bad word. You know, it's not a good thing to defend. We've seen Locke move from those radical fringes right into the centre of what we all assume are our rights. There are limits to Locke's thought, but I think those core values of a religious scepticism that says, I can only know what's true for myself, I'm not going to impose on anybody else, and this absolute conviction that politics and religion are two separate affairs are valuable things for us to ponder on. I don't think Locke has the answers, but as long as we take those sets of values as the core debate, then we can move on.
Justin Champion from Royal Holloway, University of London. In the United States of America, a country arguably created around a Lockean mode of governance, the spirit of toleration appears to flourish without the same kind of anguished debate. Locke's political and religious philosophy might have been crafted here in Europe, but they've been implemented in America.
Religious toleration in a variety of ways has been increased in contemporary America. Islamic communities are met with much greater receptivity than they are in many parts of Europe now. The controversies over the headscarf and the veil and so forth that we see in European countries are non-existent in the United States. So religious toleration has been institutionalized and expanded in the course of American history. But it's also been a paradigm for other forms of toleration where America has had more difficult struggles to accept greater racial and ethnic and cultural diversity over time. And actually, these are themes that are anticipated in Locke in the letter concerning toleration. He says at one point, Suppose this business of religion
were let alone, and that there were some other distinction made between men and men upon account of their different complexions, shapes, and features, so that those who have black hair or grey eyes should not enjoy the same privileges as other citizens. Can it be doubted that these persons, distinguished from one another by the colour of their hair and eyes, and united by the common persecution, would be as dangerous to the magistrates as any others that had associated themselves merely upon the account of religion?
That's an argument that says if you're discriminating against any group for an illegitimate, improper reason, then that's as unjust as religious persecution, and it's going to lead to upheaval. And that has had a large influence on America. It's why arguments for religious toleration were picked up by the civil rights movement as arguments for greater racial inclusion. And in this way, arguments of religious toleration beginning in Locke have led to modern civil rights struggles and America's considerable modern embrace of multiculturalism.
Someone who has found asylum in this tolerant, multicultural America is the Somali-born former Dutch politician Ayaan Hirsi Ali. After collaborating with the filmmaker Theo van Gogh and herself making a range of controversial statements on the nature of Islam, Hirsi Ali has had to go into hiding in the United States from Islamic militants. She spoke to us there from a secret location. no longer safe in her original country of refuge, she ironically blames the Dutch system of live and let live, the so-called pillarisation policy, for inadvertently nurturing a new culture of religious intolerance.
This is the unique characteristic of Holland. Even though for an outsider, a relative outsider like me, when I came to Holland, everyone had a white skin and blue eyes and light hair, among themselves and in relation to themselves, they could consider each other very, very foreign and very, very different. But to an outsider, what you see is a homogeneous country. Homogeneity meaning they speak the same language, originated from the same culture, especially the fight with the water. They face the same geographical challenges. And then they subdivided themselves along ideas and along the lines of income. So you have Protestants, Catholics, and then you have the Social Democrats who represent an underclass, and then the Liberals, all these minorities who speak the same language and share the same history coexisted without violence by accepting that they could have these different ideas, and respect and toleration simply meant not imposing your set of ideas on the other minority. You respected that. Then a completely different minority came, the immigrants from non-Western societies who do not speak the same language, and with a new religion, Islam. And the response to Holland was by trying to accommodate the new minority in the same way they accommodated each other as minorities. In other words, simply by offering them their own pillar of seclusion. So they could have their mosques, they could have their schools, if they wanted to and could afford to, even their own hospitals, even their own, you know, because that's the Dutch history of pillarization, was one pillar lived almost a parallel existence, and you could live in the same village or in the same town, but you had no contact. Only the elite had contact with one another.
But today, there's a new reason for the Dutch to be shocked.
A Dutch filmmaker who made a feature about domestic violence against Muslim women has been murdered in Amsterdam. Thea van Gogh's film caused...
Walking in the street in Amsterdam, in the east part of Amsterdam...
Dutch and Moroccan nationality has been arrested.
Now know is that that person had a knife. With that knife, he stuck in his body. And after that, he also shot at Mr. van Gogh.
We've now returned to Holland, where John Locke first developed these ideas we've been tracing through history. We're back in Amsterdam at the Oosterpark, at the striking monument which commemorates the life and then brutal murder of Theo van Gogh, a polemicist, a controversialist, a filmmaker who was murdered in the name of religion, an act which really shook Dutch society to the core. Joining me to discuss the implications of that murder is Dr. Pickle Herring from the University of Amsterdam. Dr. Pickle Herring, tell us something about this.
Well, Theo van Gogh was a fierce advocate of the freedom of expression, and he really wanted to stretch the limits of the freedom of expression to find out how far he could go. And that was extremely important for him because he thought that the freedom of expression was something which was one of the most lofty ideals of the West. And he was proud about that. And he thought it was very important also to be aggressive about it. In a way, hurt other people's feelings, to really provoke them. And that went so far that slowly but surely his life became endangered because the Muslims didn't accept this any longer. He also started making films for Hirsi Ali. And she wanted to make this film. It was called Submission. And it was a film about the character of Islam, and it tried to show that the Islam was a religion which suppressed people, it was exploitative.
Oh Allah, Most High, life with my husband is hard to bear, but I submit my will to you.
And Theo van Gogh was one of the people who made this film, and his life became even more endangered after that, and he always refused to have any people who guarded him, and in the end, eventually, it led to his murder. He was brutally murdered by a Muslim fundamentalist, and it shocked and wracked our society, and we are still living with it. We have to live with it.
Threats and warning beat me.
Bayan Hirsi-Ali, co-author with Theo van Gogh of the film Submission.
The new dimension that the death of Theo van Gogh brought with it is there is an individual who says, I feel so offended as to follow the religion to kill the one who insults my religious icons. That is the argument in court of Mohamed Bouyeri. But since the 15th century, nothing like that had happened in Holland. No bloodshed on the grounds of religion. That has, in a way, paralyzed the debate and the mind of the Dutch individual, because a Dutch individual used to this long history of toleration just doesn't know how to deal with it. But there is an undercurrent of resentment from the Dutch population saying, here is discrimination on the grounds of religion, and this is not being tolerant, this is not positive discrimination, this is contrary to our history and the consensus of not tolerating intolerance. Because Holland and also the UK, two very similar places and two places that have adopted the idea of multiculturalism early on, because we tend to leave people alone to do their thing for a long time, things like this, when they were noticed, were just dismissed as eccentricities that will pass. And I think that's what makes places like Holland vulnerable.
Perhaps it may not be amiss to add a few things concerning heresy and schism. A Turk is not, nor can be, either heretic or schismatic to a Christian. And if any man fall off from the Christian faith to Mohammedism, he does not therefore become a heretic or a schismatic, but an apostate and an infidel.
Dr. Pickle-Herring, you're a philosopher. Are you influenced as much by the religious context within which you're working as, say, the people we're talking about in this programme, our 17th century forebears? They themselves were influenced by the wars of religion, by questions of the rights of dissenters, the rights of Jews. Does this inform your own work today?
I think very much so. And in a certain sense, I feel I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. When I first read these texts, I felt they were very far off, and that these texts were about a different world, and that it wasn't my world. After all, I have no religious background. My parents were atheists, and I didn't have anything to do with religion. I was also one of these people who also believed that modernity meant the coming of a secular society, and that religion would eventually disappear. And the more I understand that religion is here to stay, the more I become aware of the similarities between the 17th century and our society. And it's suddenly the realization of the freshness of these ideas, of their power and of their importance. And that's what I really have come to understand through discussions on integration and on our approach and attitude towards Muslim society.
These things might have been explained more largely and more advantageously, but it is enough to have hinted at them thus briefly to a person of your parts.
Just as in the 17th century, when the English philosopher John Locke came here to Holland to write his letter concerning toleration, these two nations, England and Holland, are once again wrestling with very similar dilemmas over the extent of religious toleration. Then, there's a question of securing freedom for differing religious opinions from an autocratic state, for giving the space for Anglicans, dissenters, Jews and Muslims, but not Roman Catholics or atheists, to worship freely so long as they did not disturb the public order. Today, it's more a question of marrying religion and irreligion, in many cases a politicised Islam and secular liberalism, all fused through extra layers of race, ethnicity and post-colonialism. John Locke was, of course, a man of his time, contending with the dilemmas of his time. But his principled clarion call for the right of individual religious conscience, and within that tradition, a broader right for freedom of expression, however uncomfortable and unnerving, surely has just as much applicability now as it did in the 17th century.
Ideas, the British version, is presented by Tristram Hunt. Readings were by Johan Meredith, and the producer was Neil McCarthy.
On BBC Radio 3 on Thursday night, the great Italian pianist Maurizio Pollini in recital. In a recent concert from London's Royal Festival Hall, Pollini plays Chopin, Schumann and Debussy, a performance hailed by the critics, a reminder, they said, that on such form Pollini has few peers among today's pianists, a vintage example of his fascinating pianism. Join me, Susie Klein, to see what all the fuss was about. Thursday night's performance on 3, starting, as usual, at 7 o'clock.
Tonight's Words and Music takes the themes of birth and rebirth, with words by Dorothy Parker and Christina Rossetti, and music by Bach, Delius and Peter Warlock. That's all coming up in a few minutes. So to take us up to that time, there's time to hear a piece by Gluck from his opera Orfeo ed Euridice. This is the Dance of the Blessed Spirits, in an arrangement by Fritz Kreisler. Gil Shaham and Akira Eguchi were playing The Dance of the Blessed Spirits by Gluck, arranged by Fritz Kreisler. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a minute past 11. Time now for Words and Music. Josette Simon and Julian Rhine-Tutt read poetry and prose on the theme of birth and rebirth, going right back to the very start of it all.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, Let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. and the evening and the morning were the first day.
I thank you, God, for most this amazing day. For the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky. And for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings, and of the gay, great happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing any, lifted from the no of all nothing, human merely being, doubt, unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened.
Always the same, when on a fated night, at last the gathered snow lets down as white as may be in dark woods. And with a song, it shall not make again all winter long, of hissing on the yet uncovered ground. I almost stumble, looking up and round, as one who, overtaken by the end, gives up his errand and lets death descend upon him where he is, with nothing done to evil, no important triumph won, more than if life had never been begun. Yet all the precedent is on my side. I know that winter death has never tried the earth, but it has failed. The snow may heap in long storms and undrifted 4 feet deep as measured against maple, birch and oak. It cannot check the peeper's silver croak. And I shall see the snow all go downhill in water of a slender April rill that flashes tail through last year's withered brake and dead weeds like a disappearing snake. Nothing will be left white, but here a birch, and there a clump of houses with a church.
The years at the spring, and days at the morn, mornings at 7, the hillsides dew-pearled, the larks on the wing, the snails on the thorn, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world.